So we are, again, talking about the fact that we are ambassadors for Christ to Muslims, and ambassadors want to learn and engage. Okay, so we're in the section of what does it take for an ambassador to learn about Islam. We just learned about a tactic for figuring out what is Islamic and what is not, and that is looking at authoritative sources, not merely what Muslims claim. And then we learned some of the required behaviors, which are the five pillars of Islam. Now we're going to look at the required beliefs, the required doctrinal positions that Muslims must take. And this is called the six articles of faith. Now, here's the first one, which, by the way, also happens to be the most important and foundational doctrine in Islam. If you remember nothing else about their theology, know this. They are required to believe in what's called the unity of God, which means they believe there is only one God, and this one God exists as one person. So what teaching in Christianity is this a clear rejection of?
Trinity.
Trinity, that's right. In fact, chapter 112, or Surah 112 of the Quran, is a chapter devoted to proclaiming that Allah is one, and that he couldn't have any kind of associate or offspring, if you will, the way they kind of describe it. And so this is a very anti-Trinitarian chapter. Very short, just a few sentences, okay? So notice, they are required to believe that you cannot claim anyone or anything is divine other than Allah. And so to say that Jesus is divine or the Son of God would be to violate this teaching. Now, if you do violate this teaching, you are committing the most grievous sin in Islam, which is called the sin of shirk. And the sin of shirk is an unpardonable sin, which means if you've committed shirk, meaning believe, say, Jesus is the Son of God or part of the Trinity, then you've violated this doctrine, you've committed shirk, and you are guaranteed to go to hell. Okay? So do not pass go, do not collect 200, go directly to hell. It's like the worst sin, right? Just not a lot of Monopoly players here anymore, huh? Okay, whatever. Yeah, let's do this question. The question that often comes up when we discuss who Allah is, do Muslims and Christians worship the same God? And what's surprising about this question is that there's a lot of variation in the answers. In fact, even Christians who I bet you would respect and think are Orthodox have different opinions on this question. Some say we do worship the same God. Others say we don't worship the same God. So in the spirit of controversy, I'm going to throw my hat into the ring here and offer my opinion and my reason for why I think that. And if you differ, it's okay. I'm not going to be upset. But here's my take on this question. I don't think we worship the same God as Muslims. And I want to give you why I think that's the case, right? The word God is not God's name. The word God is more like the title of a position than it is the name of a person. Okay? So the title of the position is God, or the office of God, and the person who occupies that position is a who. So you have the separation of a what and a who. The what is the office of God, and the who is the person who occupies that office. So think of the office of the President of the United States. Notice, that is the title of a position. It's a what, okay? And that the office of the President of the United States entails certain powers, right? Executive powers, veto power, the power to nominate federal judges, and so on and so forth, right? But different people in an election are vying to become the person who will occupy that office. So again, we have a distinction between the office of the President of the United States and the name of the person, whether it's Trump or Biden or whoever, who occupies that office. In the same way, I think Christians and Muslims both believe in the same office of God. They believe in the same what? That there is a God who creates, who hears prayer, who administrates his kingdom. But I believe that we have a different idea of the person who occupies that office. And so Muslims believe that the person who occupies that office is Allah, and Christians believe that the person who occupies the office of God is named Yahweh. Now, when you look at the characteristics and qualities of Allah and Yahweh, what you come to discover is that they differ in fundamental ways. Right? Allah is a Unitarian God, one God who exists as one person. Yahweh is a Trinitarian God, one God who exists as three persons. Allah does not have a son. Yahweh has a son. Allah is transcendent, which means he is separate from his creation. Yahweh is also transcendent, but Yahweh is also what we would call in Christian theology immanent, which means he enters into creation and develops a relationship with his created beings. And Jesus is the epitome of that immanence. And so you can kind of go down the line and look at the qualities and characteristics of Allah and Yahweh and come to realize these are fundamentally different persons. And so this is why I say I don't believe we worship the same God. Yes, we both believe in the same office of this God who creates and, you know, whatever, but we have a different idea of the person who occupies that office. And so that's why I think it's confusing, because it feels like, well, we both have this idea that there's a God out there who does this stuff. And yeah, what that God, his office, is similar in Islam and Christianity, but when you start looking at the fundamentals of the person who occupies that office, we're talking about a completely different person. Let me answer this question in a different route. Imagine for a moment that Jesus was to appear right here and right now in front of us. I submit to you that those of us who are Christians in this room would bow down and worship that person, Jesus. And we worship him as God. However, if there's a Muslim in this room, there is no way that Muslim would bow down and worship Jesus as God. Why? Because for a Christian to worship Jesus as God is a great act of devotion. But for a Muslim to worship Jesus as God is to commit the most grievous sin in Islam, the sin of shirk, which is guaranteed to send him to hell forever. So how could it be that we both worship the same God when we both do not worship this person, Jesus, as God? Right? We worship this God here, but Muslims would never worship that person as God. So this is why I say it doesn't seem to me like we worship the same God. So anyways, that's just my two cents in the Q&A. If you're like, you're ridiculous, what are you talking about? That's fine. All right. I get it all the time, trust me. All right. Another required belief in Islam is belief in God's angels. Muslims are required to believe that Allah created angels. They do not have free will. They simply administrate Allah's kingdom. Muslims will also say that there are two angels that follow each and every one of you throughout your entire life. One angel keeps track of all your good deeds. The other angel keeps track of all your bad deeds. So in case you were wondering what that whispering sound was last night when you were all alone, could everyone else name? Another bad deed. No, I'm sure it was a good deed. Muslims are also required to believe in God's prophets. Now, God's prophets are human beings who have been commissioned to fulfill this role of prophet. And Muslims would say that every people group throughout all of history has had someone who was a prophet for that particular people group. And what's interesting is that many of the people who are identified as prophets in Islam also turn out to be characters in the scripture, in our Bible. So, for example, Muslims say, well, like Adam is, and Adam and Eve was a prophet of Allah. Moses was a prophet of Allah. The Quran would teach that David is also a prophet of Allah. The Quran in Islam teaches that Jesus is also a prophet of Allah. And, of course, they believe that Muhammad is also a prophet of Allah. Just FYI, the reason I put photo not available is not because I don't have a photo of Muhammad, but I do, not that it's a photo, but like a depiction. As you probably know, showing images of Muhammad is considered extremely offensive in Islam. To be honest, actually, Muslims don't even like to show pictures of any of the prophets. But since many Muslims attend my events, you know, if I showed a picture of Muhammad, they just get very, very angry, you know. I mean, as you know, in the past, right, when, the newspaper in the Netherlands showed depictions of Muhammad in a cartoon fashion, there were riots all over the world. Embassies were set ablaze. 139 people were killed because people showed pictures of Muhammad.
It was France.
It was France recently. France was just reposting them recently. And because a French teacher just last year showed those same cartoons, he was killed. And then it happened another time, some other church was attacked because of the same thing. But before that, it was many years ago when it was the Netherlands that newspaper posted it. So anyway, so for that reason, that's why I don't show pictures of Muhammad. But I will tell you that historically, I think between the 12th and 15th century, many Muslims actually drew artwork of Muhammad, and it wasn't considered inappropriate. So if you go to like the Louvre in France and other famous museums, they actually have historical paintings that show how Muslims have depicted Muhammad. Anyways, all this being said, the point I'm trying to make here is that, notice, belief in Jesus is required by Muslims. Now, of course, it's important to recognize that their version of Jesus is not the biblical or true account of who Jesus is. Right? They do not believe Jesus is the Son of God, because that would be the sin of shirk. Right. They don't believe that Jesus is part of the Trinity. Yeah? They don't believe that Jesus was crucified. And if he wasn't crucified, of course, they can't believe that Jesus was ever resurrected. And if he didn't die and rise again, then Jesus could have possibly atoned for sins. Right? So on their account, Jesus is merely a human being who is commissioned to be a prophet. Just like we would say, we believe Moses was merely a human being commissioned to be a prophet. And just like Muslims would say, Muhammad was merely a human being who was commissioned to be a prophet. Now, despite this lower Christology, despite this lower theological view of Jesus than the true Jesus, it's still interesting when you read the Quran to see what the Quran, the highest authority in Islam, what it says about Jesus. I read through the Quran and took note of everything it says about Jesus. It's fascinating. According to their highest authority, the Quran teaches that Jesus' birth was announced by angels. The Quran teaches that Jesus was born of the Virgin Mary. The Quran teaches that Jesus was able to perform miracles like heal sick people and even raise the dead. The Quran teaches that Jesus lived a sinless and perfect life. The Quran even calls Jesus the Messiah. And according to the Quran, at the end of Jesus' life, he was taken up to be in the presence of Allah. And even according to the Quran, Jesus is appointed to return at the end of time to kill the Antichrist, to break all the crosses, and to kill the pigs. So no more bacon, wrapped filet mignon at that point, okay? Which is a big bummer, because bacon, wrapped filet mignon is, like, amazing, right? I mean, because filet mignon itself as a meat is incredibly tender, but I've often found that it doesn't have as much flavor as, say, like a ribeye, which has more of that marbled meat, like, or fat. So I've always been torn by that, you know? So it's like, okay, how do you solve this problem? Bacon wrapped filet mignon. You take the filet, you wrap it in bacon, you've got the tenderness of the filet, but the flavor of a ribeye. It's like, oh, just beautiful, right? Thankfully, this theology is not true, so we're not going to lose all our pigs. So we'll still have that, hopefully in afterlife, right? But notice, this is significant, right? This is a fairly high view of Jesus. Granted, it's not biblical, but it's still a high view of Jesus. Now, what's more interesting is when you contrast this teaching about what the Quran says about Jesus with what the Quran says about Muhammad. Because the Quran does not have any announcement of Muhammad's birth. It doesn't say he performed miracles. It doesn't say he was sinless. The Quran does not call Muhammad the Messiah. And according to the Quran, Muhammad has been dead and buried in Saudi Arabia for the last 1,400 years. And he's not appointed to ever come back again. Now, this is very interesting, and what it tells me is that I have tremendous freedom to talk about Jesus with my Muslim friends and neighbors, because he's talked about even more highly than Muhammad in the Quran, which, again, is their highest authority. So, again, this is, I think, very, very fascinating. And I find that not only Christians don't know about this, but many Muslims, when you start telling them about how Jesus is so elevated in the Quran, it's rather significant to them as well. Now, another required belief in Islam is belief in God's books. Right? The Quran teaches that and names four divine revelations by name that I would argue the Quran teaches are on par with one another. Okay? Four divine revelations that were given to different prophets in different times. So the Quran, for example, names itself as one of those divine revelations, right? The Quran is the word of Allah given to which prophet in Islam? Muhammad, okay, right. Can anyone tell me the names of one of the other three divine revelations given to prophets that is on par with the Quran? What's that? Okay, Bible, let's be more specific.
It's not right. The new Torah.
Okay, Torah, right? The Torah, the first five books of the Old Testament, is identified in the Quran as a true revelation from Allah given to which prophet? Moses, right? Moses is a prophet in Islam. Do you want to know one of the other two remain?
Injil.
The Injil is another word for gospel. And the Quran identifies the gospel as a true revelation given to Jesus that is on par with the Quran. And there's one more. Does anybody know what that fourth one is? Who were the prophets that you saw in that previous slide?
David.
Psalms, that's right. The Psalms are also identified in the Quran as a true revelation from Allah given to the prophet David. Now, I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, wait a minute. Let's just take the gospel for example. If the gospel is identified as a true revelation from Allah given to Jesus, like Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, well, then how is it that Muslims then don't believe what the gospels teach? Because Jesus claims to be divine. Jesus claimed to predict his death. The Gospels talk about him getting crucified and resurrecting and atoning for sins. These are all things that Muslims vigorously disagree with. So what does the Muslim say in response to the fact that their highest authority, the Quran, teaches that the Gospel is a true revelation from Allah? What's the response?
Everything else corrupted.
That's right. They will say that although the Quran identifies the Torah, Psalms, and Gospel as true revelations, only the Quran has remained free from corruption. The other three have become corrupted either intentionally by Christians and Jews who wanted to change it, or unintentionally they were just irresponsible and weren't caring for these documents, and over time they let them get corrupted. And so now they believe, that the Torah, Psalms, and Gospel, although those were true revelations from Allah, man's writings have been mixed in together with those documents. And so now what we have in the Torah, Psalms, and Gospel contains some of the truth of Allah, but it also contains some of the teachings of humanity, of humans. Okay? And so for that reason, you say, yeah, of course, these were revelations that were, you know, identified in the Quran as true, but only the Quran remained free from corruption. Do you have a clarifying question?
Yeah, is that why they're so big on specifying that the Quran was dictated?
Well, is that why they specified that the Quran was dictated? Well, they would argue that probably the same type of revelation was given in the same way as the other one. So it would be an angel came to Muhammad, came to Moses, came to David, came to Jesus. So it was probably, they would argue, dictated the same way. But they would just say, conveniently, that, oh yeah, but these are corrupted. Now, this claim that the Bible is corrupted is the most common objection you run across when talking to a Muslim. It's not the most common objection. It's, I would argue, a very serious objection, especially when it comes to evangelism, because I want to turn to Jesus since they have to believe in him anyways, and he's the center of our faith. And the story of Jesus and his words and his claims are found where? In the gospel. So that's the very source of authority the Muslims are going to say, you can't tell me about Jesus from the gospel. We got to take that off the table because that's corrupted. So I want to teach you a tactic that I use to respond to that because I want to get the gospel back on the table so I can share about who Jesus is from the gospels. So how do I deal with the claim of corruption? Well, when I read the Quran, I also noticed something else, and that is it teaches two things that are very, very significant for our purposes. The Quran teaches, number one, that no one can change the words of Allah. And these are four references, there is probably 12 total where we see over and over the Quran making the claim, no one can change the words of God. The words of God can't be changed. No one can corrupt the words of God. The words of God are everlasting. They never change, blah, 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 blah. Okay? So no one can change the words of God. So that's one thing the Quran teaches over and over again. But the second thing the Quran teaches is that the Bible, and when I say Bible, I'm talking Torah, Psalms, and Gospel, that the Bible is an example of the Word of God. And this is taught in these four passages, and indeed probably 10 others, where the Quran repeatedly makes references to the Torah, Psalms, and Gospel in a way that presumes its authoritative nature as the Word of Allah. So notice then what logically follows by virtue of premise one and premise two being true. The conclusion is, therefore, according to the Quran, the Bible, meaning Torah, Psalms, and Gospel, and the one I'm really interested in here is the Gospel, that the Gospel then is the uncorrupted word of Allah. Right? This is what we call in logic or philosophy a valid deductive argument, which means if premise one is true, premise two is true, then this conclusion logically follows by necessity. It has to be true. And the Quran is incredibly clear and univocal about this claim and this claim. So you see the logic? If no one can change the words of God, and the gospel is the word of God, then the gospel is the unchanged word of God. So although Muslims claim the Bible is corrupted or the gospel is corrupted, their highest authority says the opposite. This is incredibly good news. Again, I'm not trying to presuppose or presume that the Quran is the word of law. I'm just simply saying, according to them, their own authority says the opposite of what they're claiming. In fact, many years ago, I was invited to this prison, which it's called Sentinel State Prison. It's in Southern California near the border of Mexico. Now, I don't know if you are aware, but getting out of prison is hard, but actually getting into prison is pretty hard, too. There's an incredible number of background checks that you have to go through before you ever get in. But the Christian chaplain at this prison invited me to come one day. And he said, Alan, he goes, look, we have a ton of Christians in this prison. There's probably about 250 at the time that I was there. But in addition to Christians, we have a ton of Muslims in the prison as well. And many of these Christians are in a small cell with another Muslim. And guess what? They have a lot of time on their hands. And they said to me, it would be great if you can come to this prison and teach the Christians how to witness to their Muslim cellmates. I'm like, okay, that sounds intriguing. Sure, I'll do it. So I get there, and as you can imagine, I had two security guards who escorted me through all of the security measures that they have at the prison. So first, there was like this door that split open. The two security guards escorted me through the door. Door closed behind us. Then there's an electric fence that opened up. The two security guards escorted me through the electric fence. Closed behind us. Then there is this other kind of wall thing that kind of opened up. Two security guards escorted me through that wall. Closed behind us. Then we finally got to this to these yards, which is like a prison yard, where it's just surrounded by just a regular fence. That fence opened up. I stepped inside. The fence closed behind me. And as I turned around, I noticed that the guards remained on the other side. I thought that was interesting. I said, what are you doing? They said, oh, you didn't know? I said, no, what? They said, are you going to be here for the whole day by yourself? We'll come and get you at 4 p.m. Have a good time. I'm like, well, that doesn't sound very safe, right? I mean, I'm standing there. All the prisoners are looking at me. I'm the only one wearing plain clothes. I'm like, this feels awkward. A number of the prisoners start to walk towards me, and I'm like, oh, my gosh, I'm going to die. So I'm like, okay, I'm going to pull the Stephen is a martyr thing, and I fall on my knees. Into your hands, Jesus, I commit my spirit. And, you know. So one of the prisoners comes up to me. He's like, are you Brother Alan? I'm like, Brother Alan, you know me? Yes, I'm Brother Alan. I'm any brother you want me to be. Thank God you know me. He goes, yeah, he goes, I'm one of the Christians here. We heard you're coming. I'm like, oh, thank God. He goes, man, we're so glad to have you. We're looking forward to your presentation. He goes, do you have any handout notes to give us? I said, sure. So I gave him a piece of paper. He handed that piece of paper to another prisoner who went off to make photocopies of my material. And I'm like, they have photocopy machines in a maximum security state prison? Like, that's weird. But whatever. Now, the guy, the prisoner going to make photocopies, turned out he was a Muslim. So as he's walking to make photocopies, he's reading the notes he's going to photocopy. He's like, hey, there's a Christian here who's going to be talking about Islam later on. So in addition to making photocopies, you know what else he does? He tells all the Muslim prisoners. And so that afternoon, I'm in a room, probably half the size of this room, and all these Christians are pouring in, and all these Muslim prisoners are pouring in as well. And I'm like, I am going to die today. Because this is like maximum security prison. They got life sentences. Not all of them, but a lot of them. Like, they killed one more person. Like, what's the big deal? Like, what's another 30 years in their term? So I'm like, well, I'm stuck here till 4, so might as well go down in the blaze of glory. So I'm like, all right, I'm just going to do my presentation. So I went through the previous slide's material in a more in-depth fashion. And then I got to the end, I made my case, you know, that the Quran does not say the Bible is corrupt, it says it's actually trustworthy. And so therefore we can look to see, Muslims can read the gospel and see what it says about Jesus. So I said, are there any questions? This is the end. Now all the Christians had their hands down, because they're wondering, what are their Muslim friends gonna say, right? So one Muslim raises his hand and says, yes, sir. He goes, I was following along with what you were saying, and I was actually looking at the verses in the Quran that you cited that made these claims, and he said, I have to conclude that what you're saying is actually true. You're right, that the Quran does not say the Bible is corrupted. I'm like, oh, okay, well, thank you. Another Muslim raises his hand. He says, yes, because I haven't seen this approach before, but I agree with you. The Quran does not accuse the Bible from being corrupted. It is trustworthy and reliable. I'm like, what? Then a third Muslim jumps out of his seat. He turns to his Muslim friends. He says, brothers, how can you agree with this Christian? Of course the Bible is corrupted. And then he proceeds to cite a verse in the Quran, which if you read it on a superficial level, it sounds like it says that the Bible is corrupted. But then guess who comes to my defense at that moment? The Muslims. The two Muslims stand up and say, no, sit down, brother. What you're saying is not true. It doesn't say the Christians have a corrupted Bible. It says the Christians misinterpret the Bible, but the text has remained pure. Now, notice why this tactic worked. It wasn't because I just presented a historical defense of the Bible's reliability, which would have been rejected by them because they're going to say, well, this is man's wisdom versus Islam. Like, why would we believe a man, right? What I did was I leveraged their commitment to the Quran as an authority to my advantage. I said, you're claiming the Bible's corrupted, but according to your authority, the highest authority in Islam, the Quran, it says the Bible's trustworthy. Torah, Psalms, and Gospel. And so at that point, I said, so therefore, we can look at what the Gospels say about Jesus. And then I was able to go and turn to the Gospels to talk about what did Jesus say? What did he claim? How did he live? What happened? And so this is what I recommend, this approach to dealing with that particular objection. And that's why I was mentioning my book. In this book, the vast majority of the book is geared towards this objection and unpacking it. Although I think we might be sold out, but if there aren't any, if you go to our website, str.org, you can order digital versions or paper versions or whatever you want of it. But anyways, that was a little bit of a tangent. I want to get back to the required behavior beliefs. So we just covered Muslims are required to believe in God's books, and now we've seen that even the gospel can be considered a trustworthy book for the Muslim, even though most Muslims don't know that. And then a fifth required belief in Islam is the belief in the final judgment. And what they would say is at the end of time, all people will be resurrected and then judged by Allah according to their deeds. And all your good and bad deeds will be put on a scale. And how will we know what good and bad deeds you have? Yeah, those angels, those creepy stalkers who have been following you your whole life. Like, they're going to bring all your good and bad deeds, put them on a scale. If your good deeds outweigh your bad deeds, you go to heaven. If your bad deeds outweigh your good deeds, you go to hell. So again, notice, it's a meritorious-based system of salvation. It's based on what you do. Okay? Now, because of this, many Muslims would say they have no idea whether they're going to heaven or not, because they don't know what that final accounting is going to be. And this presents us with a very interesting opportunity that I often take advantage of, which is if I want to get to the gospel in under a minute with a Muslim, how do I do it? Well, I ask him a very simple question. Here's the question. Are you 100% certain you're going to heaven? Now, I've asked Muslims in the Middle East and the United States this question. I've never had one Muslim say to me, yes, I'm 100% certain. And the reason they're not 100% certain, they'll say, is because we don't know. Like, it's up to Allah to weigh our deeds, you know, the merits of it. I can't know. Then I ask him, would you like to have 100% certainty? Now, at this point, they're either just curious to see what I'm going to say, like, oh yeah, sure, how? Or they actually generally want that certainty. Because what can we as Christians offer them in virtue of what Christ has done? Certainty, confidence in their salvation. And so then I just simply say, okay, and then I can explain what the gospel says, right? What did Jesus claim about the nature of the kingdom of God and salvation? I just unpack it from the gospels. Now they say, oh, but Alan, that's the corrupted text. Well, then I can bring in that tactic that shows that their Quran says it's not corrupted. I get that objection off the table, and then I go back to the gospel. So notice what I'm doing. I'm starting with the gospel, talking about who Jesus is and what he did. If they give me a hard time about it being corrupted, I use that tactic to get the objection off the table, and I go back to the gospel. But the way I get to the gospel is by simply asking a key question. Are you 100% certain? Notice, I don't ask, are you confident in your salvation? I'm asking, are you 100% certain? And they'll say no, and I'll say, well, would you like to have 100% certainty? Sure, how's that? And then I present the gospel. So that's how we get to the gospel, boom, just 60 seconds of there. Not that you have to do it in 60 seconds. I mean, if you have a long-standing relationship, then that's not necessary. But oftentimes, I don't have a lot of time. Maybe we're doing street evangelism. Maybe we're at a mosque, and there isn't a whole, you know, forever to talk about it. So that's my approach. And a sixth required belief in Islam is the belief in divine destiny, which is this idea that everything that occurs in all the universe is according to the divine decree of Allah. And Allah knows what his creatures will do. He doesn't determine it necessarily, but he knows what's going to happen, and so he can allow it to happen then. Somewhat of a debated theological idea, but nevertheless, that's the sixth required belief. So we've unpacked the required beliefs of Islam, and we've kind of unpacked what it takes for an ambassador to understand about Islam. This isn't as long, this next section, but I just want to close with a couple of thoughts about the fact that as an ambassador, we can't just learn about Islam, we need to engage Muslims, all right? We can't stand on the sidelines any longer, especially now that we're equipped. We need to get in the game and start sharing the truth with them. And let me tell you, this is actually surprisingly easy. I remember when I first started witnessing to Muslims, I was living in a part of Southern California that was very close to a large neighborhood that had a high population of Muslims. And so I drove to the neighborhood, I'm like, okay, I'm gonna find some Muslims to talk to. I'm gonna start somewhere, right? So I pull over, I see some restaurant signs that are written in Arabic script. I'm like, this must be the right place, you know? I get out, I'm looking around for some people that might look like me, you know? So I see these two guys, they look kind of like me, they're walking into a restaurant, I'm like, oh, they must be Muslims, right? So I run up to them, just as they are walking in the door, I kind of put my hand in front of the door, I said, hold on a second, I said, wait a minute, are you guys Muslims? Now this is shortly after 9/11, so they're a little bit skittish about that question. They're like, yeah, we're Muslim, why? I said, oh, great, I said, I'm a Christian. Hey, he said, would you like to talk about God and Jesus in the Bible? They're like, sure, yeah, well, we're happy to talk about it too. Why don't you come in and sit down with us and we'll chat. I'm like, oh, okay, wonderful. We sit down, we have a meal together, and for hours talk about God and Jesus and the Bible, had an absolutely fabulous time. Of course we disagreed on a whole host of things. Finally, after 2 hours, I'm like, oh man, my wife's probably wondering, like, is Alan dead? Like, where is he? You know? So I go, guys, I had a great time. I got to go, though, okay? So I reach in my wallet to take some money out to pay for the parts of the meal that I had ordered. And they said, no. They said, stop. They said, put your money away. We insist on paying for your part of the meal as well. Now, I want you to contrast that experience with what would have happened had I gone to a typical U.S. mall, walked up to two average Americans, and said to them, excuse me, I'm a Christian. Would you like to talk about Jesus in the Bible? What do you think they'd say? Yeah, no, or more like, get lost, freak. Like, no, I don't want to talk about Jesus. Like, what's the matter with you? Get out of my face, you know? But this tells us something about Muslims. They love to talk about God and Jesus and the Bible. And starting a conversation with a Muslim about religion is like starting a conversation with an American about sports, right? It's virtually effortless. You just start it and it goes. And so we should take advantage of this wide open opportunity that we have to talk to a massive group of people who is perfectly comfortable talking about religion. What are the two topics you can't talk about at work? Politics and religion. You know what two topics Muslims love to talk about?
Politics
and religion, right? Skip the politics, just go for the religion. Go for the gospel, right? I mean, it's like, what an opportunity. It's not at all like talking to an American where it's like, oh, should I bring up religion? Like, I'm not sure. It's like, you bring up religion to Muslim, like, yeah, yeah, fine. It's like talking about cilantro, you know? It's just whatever. No, it's talking, you know? So, so easy. Turns out also, there's a lot of Muslims to talk to. Maybe not here in Billings, but I'll just say that there's 1.5 billion Muslims on the earth. That means 1 in 5 people on the planet is a Muslim. That's a lot of Muslims, right? And from a missions perspective, Muslims represent the largest unreached people group in the earth. Every day, 38,000 Muslims die and enter eternity without Jesus. 38,000. So I live in San Diego, which is near Staples Center in Los Angeles, where the Los Angeles Lakers play. That stadium, when packed, holds 18,000 people. Okay, so take Staples Center, where the NBA Lakers play, double its capacity, you have 36,000. You're just now approaching the number of Muslims that every single day are dying without Christ. Now, of those 1.5 billion Muslims, we estimate, based on CIA and other demographic data, that the vast majority of Muslims worldwide are what we would call nominal or in name only. Meaning, they're born in a Muslim country or born in a Muslim family, but they don't really practice their faith very seriously. They just kind of say, yeah, yeah, I'm a Muslim, but they don't read the Quran, they don't study the Hadith, they don't attend mosque. Even in the United States, when I go to a mosque, I say, hey, what percentage of your Islamic community comes to mosque on Fridays? To like, maybe 10%, 5%, maybe. So imams are very discouraged about that, which is understandable. But these people typically are not interested in jihad or abusing their wives or anything like that, okay? There's another 15% of Muslims worldwide that are described as reformed. They wouldn't say this, but we would describe as reformed. These are Muslims who take their faith very seriously. They study the Quran, the Hadith, the Sunnah. They attend mosque on a regular basis. But when it comes to the more un-PC aspects of the Quran, they would say, well, that was for a different time. It's not applicable today. Or they'll do some kind of rationalization where they'll say, we don't follow that aggressive behavior that's commanded in the Quran. But there's another 15% of the Muslims that the media or others would describe as radical Muslims. And these Muslims, like their Reformed brethren, do read the Quran, the Hadith, and the Sunnah, do attend mosque, but when it comes to those passages that talk about violent jihad, they would say, no, that's absolutely a part of the Quran, the Hadith, the Sunnah, and we must follow it. They would either attitudinally support violent jihad or financially back it or participate in it themselves. Now, 15% of the world's population of Muslims, we're talking like a couple hundred million people. Right? It's like two-thirds of the population of the United States. A lot of people who adhere to that. Right? So the question is, in what manner should we engage these three kinds of Muslims? And I would say we should engage them all the same way. And that would be the way an ambassador would do it, which is what we've been talking about today and yesterday. And we looked at this passage, remember yesterday, about 2 Timothy, where we're told to be kind to all, patient when wrong, with gentleness, correcting those who are in opposition. Okay, that would include Muslims. Kind to all, patient when wronged, with gentleness. That's the way we're supposed to engage all of those Muslims. And perhaps the most practical depiction of what that looks like is this. My suggestion to you, if you have the opportunity to talk to Muslims, is to avoid conversations that distract from the gospel. And instead, just focus on the gospel itself. In other words, avoid conversations that raise walls or put Muslims in a defensive posture. Like, look, We talked about violent jihad today, but my suggestion is you don't bring up violent jihad when you're talking to your Muslim friend or neighbor. Okay? Even if they were to agree with you about that subject, it's just their eternal destiny would still be in jeopardy. Because believing your beliefs about jihad doesn't save them, right? So why not focus on the gospel? If you talk about jihad, all they're going to think is, oh, you're an American Christian, like every other American Christian that just thinks that we're all jihadis. And all it'll do is just raise walls and create a defensive posture against them considering anything you say. I know a lot of Christians, or even Americans, who know a lot about Muhammad's treatment of women. That he, you know, married multiple wives, loved women. When he was in his 50s, he married a girl who was just 6 years old. Okay, and they're rightly disgusted by that. But when they get talking to their Muslim friend and neighbor, like, oh, wasn't Muhammad a pedophile? And blah, blah. I'm like, oh, geez, okay. All that's going to do is raise walls and give a much more defensive posture against anything you say. Now, I'm not saying it's not important that such a man like Muhammad did these things. The point is that if you do that, it's going to become a lot harder to ever get back to the gospel. And so that's why I say focus on the gospel and avoid conversations that distract from the gospel. Because ultimately, it doesn't matter what they think about all these tertiary or secondary things. What matters is what do they think about Jesus. Let me close with a final thought, and then we can be dismissed or take some questions here. Look, after September 11th, people said, Americans and Christians as well, they said, yeah, we are engaged in a war. They said, we are engaged in a war against terrorism and against Muslim extremists. And they're right about one thing, we are engaged in a war. That is true. As Christians, this is a war, okay? But they're wrong about two things. They're wrong about when the war began and who we are at war with. You see, the war did not begin when the first plane hit the World Trade Center, okay? The war began when Adam and Eve took their first bite. And this is not a war against Muslims. They are not the enemy. If anything, Muslims are hostages of the enemy. They are casualties of war. The real enemy is Satan, his lies, his army. He is the true terrorist. In fact, five chapters after Paul identifies us as ambassadors for Jesus Christ, he then describes the nature of the war that we're in. And interestingly, we also looked at this passage as well in 2 Corinthians 10. Notice Paul says, for though we live in the world, we don't wage war as the world does. The weapons we fight with are not the weapons of the world. It's not guns and tanks and planes and missiles. That's the weapons that the world fights with. On the contrary, the weapons we fight with have divine power to demolish strongholds. We demolish arguments and every pretension that sets itself up against the knowledge of God and take every thought captive to make it obedient to Christ. Notice, it is the enemy Satan who has erected the stronghold of Islam and has captured 20% of the world's population. And that's why between now and tomorrow, at the same moment, Satan will claim another 38,000 souls that will enter eternity without Christ. So never forget, we are at war. The enemy is real. But Muslims are not the enemy. They're hostages of the enemy. And you've been commissioned to be an ambassador for Jesus Christ to present the gospel even to Muslims. Okay, with that, any questions we can take, and we're going to use the microphone as well.
Before we take questions, Brother Allen.
We have a couple of things we want to take care of.
Oh, you need to mention the books again, I've heard.
First of all, we are out of tactics. And you can't buy it on Amazon. Don't even look. We've got you covered. We're going to have some copies of it March 5th and 6th, so we'll cover you. That might have been a little lie. The second thing is, if you can help us pay for this, please give us a check. And then I have the distinguished privilege of deciding when we invite a speaker, when we invite him back, and I never take a speaker for granted. we started out when I said, I don't know why you would come to Montana, but we have heard you're crazy, so we thought you might come. And you would be surprised, some of you, at the few that I would not invite back. And I'm interested to know what you think about me. Well, I agree, and we'll have a conversation, and I do not assume. Alan, thank you so much.
Pleasure. Thank you
for coming.
My pleasure.
We are going to take a few minutes of questions, would you help us? And again, questions, not rants. In case, I wanted to say all this in case somebody might escape out the door before we were done. Thank you for coming. There are a few brochures around if you want to give them to a friend. And we'll take a few minutes of questions. Raise your hands.
Okay, you shared with us that about the Godhead as an office, and that we've got the Trinity on one side, opponent, and Allah on the other side. Is Allah a person, and if he is, who is he?
Is Allah a person? Well, I would say Allah is not a person. He's a false god, just like... I'm sorry?
He's more of an idea, then?
Yeah, he's like an idea. I mean, just like we'd say the Baal, right? You know, the Bible describes Baal and other false gods. So I would say he's a false god, is the way I describe him. So I don't believe there is some other god that exists. You might say, well, then where does Islam come from? And who was this angel? Was it really the angel Gabriel? I mean, I would go so far as to say that it was perhaps a demonic spirit, not an angel spirit. And the reason why we actually might have good evidence to think that's the case is according to Muhammad's own testimony. When he was meditating in a cave by himself, he claimed that a spirit took hold of him and he thought he was being oppressed by a demon. That demon, or whoever that was, told him to recite. That's what Quran means, it means to recite. So he went back down the mountain and talked to his friends and family. He's like, I was just possessed by a demon. And they all said, no, it's probably not a demon. It's probably from God. Listen to it next time. So his initial instinct was to claim that whatever was speaking to him was demonic. So perhaps he should have just gone with his gut there.
And does Satan exist in
Islam? Oh, yeah, Satan does also exist in Islam, yeah. Yeah, and he's... Satan is not a fallen angel, according to Islamic theology. Satan was created in the state that he's in. So in Islam, they have angels, but they also have what's called jinn, which are these so angels don't have free will. Jinn do have free will. Angels administrate God's kingdom. Jinn are more like diabolical, mischievous creatures. Allah created both in the state that they're in.
There's a kind of a follow-on. One of the things I found kind of useful that creates some thought in people is when we, not speaking with Muslims, but speaking with Christians who have this idea that we all worship the same God, is the question, is the spirit of Islam the Holy Spirit? I have never had anyone do anything but stop.
Stop and say no, you mean?
They don't know. They just makes them really stop and think. And they start, comparing the teachings, the biblical teachings on the Holy Spirit, relative.
Right.
I can't exactly say what they're thinking. Thankfully, I can't see in their head.
Yeah. But so are you saying that by asking that question, you're demonstrating to this Christian that really they probably don't think that we're worshiping the same God in the same way that we don't believe it's the same Spirit? Is that your point?
Yes.
Yeah. That's very fascinating. I've never thought about that.
And then I noticed in your list of what they teach about Jesus that the cross and resurrection are missing.
The cross and resurrection are vigorously denied. In fact, the Quran says in one of its verses, it says, the Jews say they killed him, but they killed him not. It was only made to appear as if he was killed. So based on that verse, Muslims deny the crucifixion, and what they say was that either someone was given the appearance of Jesus, that, you know, so on the cross, the person who was put up was probably Judas, and Jesus was given the appearance of Judas, and Judas was given the appearance of Jesus. So who ended up getting crucified was Judas. So that's one claim they make. The other claim they make is that Jesus perhaps just swooned, meaning he went up on the cross, was crucified, he passed out, they thought he was dead, but he wasn't actually dead. So those are two theories that we often hear from Muslims about how to explain the claim the Quran makes that they did not kill Jesus.
Doesn't that indicate the possibility of the divine involved in the creation of this religion against Christianity? Because the crucifixion and the resurrection are the essential.
Yeah, so, right. So since the cross and resurrection are essential components of our faith, would that be evidence then towards a demonic origin to Islam? Oh, certainly. I mean, I would say every false religion, every false idea is from the evil one. So if Islam is a false religion, then it would qualify as that, just as any false religion is. I would say ultimately demonic in origin. Yeah, of course.
Okay, I have two more right here, and then the last one is because we're Republicans.
Sure, no problem.
In relation to the authenticity of the Bible and the Quran, I was wondering what you'd have to say about when Arabic came into the business of writing, where they developed writing.
When did Arabic come into writing? I mean, they had Arabic script during when the Quran was written, but it was a different script. So when I studied about Islam, we learned the different scripts, and we had to be tested on, like, okay, which script came from which era. But this is a way, so Arabic was there, I'm not sure when it began, but it was there at the time, it was just a different type of script that didn't have the diacritical marks, which are these little dots and other kinds of small things to add to the understanding of the text, which is why there's a lot of debate as to what the Quran originally says, because those diacritical marks aren't in the original script. Later script added that, but it wasn't in the original though. So anyways, I'm not sure when Arabic began, but we do know that there's been an evolution in the type of script that was used. And the type of script that's found in the Quran today is not what modern Arabic is like.
So it was my understanding that Muhammad's recitation was what developed or prompted Arabic writing to come into being. But maybe
I don't know if Muhammad's recitation of the Quran prompted, but allegedly Muhammad himself was illiterate. He couldn't read or write, allegedly. So he memorized it, and the only way it was transmitted was through recitation of the people. And then eventually, after his death, there was a push to try to write it down. And that was extremely controversial, because they're like, how can we write this down? We were never commanded to write it down, you know? We don't want to be like the Christians who have a written text and don't know, you know, what it says. There's differences in it. Another problem, though, that prompted them to write it down was because as they were expanding the Islamic Empire, as we saw from the historical evidence, the Muslims that had memorized it were getting killed in wars. So pretty soon they're like, we're going to lose the Quran just by the mere fact of the people who have memorized massive portions are getting killed in war. So like, we better write this down before we lose it all. That was one of the main reasons that prompted them to write it down. Yes?
I wondered if since the Torah was the prophet Moses, and the Psalms from David and the Gospels from Jesus, even though that seemed weird because other people wrote the books.
Right.
So did they consider themselves like a branch out of Judaism initially? Or
Muslims did not consider themselves a branch out of Judaism, but Muhammad did claim to be a prophet in the line of Abraham. Because remember, Abraham had Isaac, and Abraham also had Ishmael, right? But now, biblical theology would say that the line of prophets is through Isaac, right? To David and to Jesus. Muhammad claimed that he was in the line of Abraham, Ishmael, because the descendants of Ishmael would lead to the Arab nation, of which Muhammad was one. So he claimed to be a prophet in the line of Abraham, but the Jews around his area rejected his claim to a status as a prophet. And that's what caused the initial divisions between the Muslims and the Jews in the 7th century. So that's why they started fighting, and that's why he eventually had him executed. Those who didn't follow his teaching, because they were just like a thorn in his side. So yeah, they didn't claim to be a like an offshoot of Judaism. He claimed to be a prophet in the line of Abraham, and a basically saying that, look, the true Islam that he was teaching was what Adam and Eve were told at the beginning, and what Noah believed, and what, you know, Abraham believed, what Moses believed, and now he's just teaching the same thing. But Jews and Christians have gotten off the path, and they now have these, you know, they're the offshoots. So they're claiming that they have a true religion since the time of Adam. Does that make sense? Yeah.
Alan, one of the things that I loved about you is you're not a self-promoter. And I apologize for not doing this earlier. Would you take a few minutes to talk about what you do and what Stand to Reason does?
Yeah, so Stand to Reason, what we're about is basically what you've just seen today, only on a wide variety of topics. So our goal is to equip Christians to be able to persuasively, yet graciously, share their convictions on any topic. And so, I mean, I specialize on abortion, homosexuality, Islam, you know, tactics of engagement, and a whole bunch of things, you know. We have three other speakers, including my boss, Brett Kokel, who wrote the book Tactics. But that's pretty much our goal, is we're in the... Our mission is to train Christians, and we try to do it in the model of being an ambassador on any topic. So when it comes to abortion, for example, hugely controversial topic, I want to teach Christians to understand the knowledge of it, the wisdom, how to communicate it, and have a gracious character about yourself so that you don't unnecessarily offend. Now, don't get me wrong. Some things you'll say, no matter how gracious you say, will be offensive. I'm saying we don't want to add unnecessary offense. And so on any of these topics, that's what we're trying to do to equip people. And we have a website, we have a YouTube channel, we're on all the social media platforms, and every day our website is updated with new content. Every day, except for weekends. But Monday through Friday, our YouTube channel has new videos all the time. We are constantly creating this stuff. So we're trying to use the social media and the internet for a medium of training. But of course, we also do writing and speaking as well.
So, ton of good resources.
Yeah, and most of it's free, by the way.
Talk about the videos that you have for a minute. Maybe two or three of them.
The videos I have from, oh gosh. Well, I mean, if you go to this youtube.com, the short videos, I mean, I've got videos on everything, so I don't know what to say, but there's a ton on Islam, there's a ton on abortion, a ton on homosexuality, about transgender, bioethics, stem cell research, cloning, I couldn't even begin. So there's hundreds and hundreds just of me, and that's not including my coworkers who also produce amazing stuff. And one thing I'd recommend, by the way, if you just want to get a sampling of what we do, go to our website, str.org, and there's a place where you can subscribe to what's called Solid Ground. Now, Solid Ground is our free training article that my boss, Greg Kokel, who wrote Tactics, sends out once every 2 months. It's an awesome piece of content that deals with something like, how do we know that Jesus rose bodily from the grave? What are some causes of same-sex attraction? Why should we believe that stem cell research and cloning is immoral? What is stem cell research and cloning? You know, how do you reach out to Muslims? Like, all of these are the kind of topics that Greg writes in his article, Solid Ground, and it's sent to you free for 1 year. It doesn't cost money afterwards. We just stopped sending it to you because we don't want to impose on you. But if you're like, man, I've been getting Solid Ground for a year and I love it, yeah, could you just keep sending it to me. And we'll keep sending it to you for free. But initially, we'll stop after years. We don't want to impose. But I guarantee if you like anything you heard today, you will love Solid Ground. My boss is an amazing writer. And again, he's trying to equip you to be an effective ambassador in knowledge, wisdom, and character on whatever topic we're discussing in that letter. So again, Solid Ground, go to our website. It's free to sign up for. And you can even sign up for my own personal letter if you want, which I do my own training article as well.
How many of you have seen Greg do the trench coat thing?
Yeah, my boss does an invitation.
If you come back, you've got to do the trench coat
thing. Yeah, I don't do the trench coat thing, but I do teach on tactics. So, but yeah.
I'm going to question. Yeah. So you're talking about what you have on YouTube, whatever. Do you or your associates have any concern about future censorship?
Yes, we do have concerns about future censorship. We were banned by Google many, many years ago, actually, and labeled as a hate group back when the Boy Scouts were more prominent and maybe sticking to some of the values that we would think are more or good, whatever, however you put it. But we asked Google, why did you ban us? They said, because you spewed hate. We said, could you give us an example of what the hate was? And this was the comment that my boss said on the radio, because we have a radio show. He said, it's not hard to see how the values of the Boy Scouts are more lofty than the values of the LGBT community. That's all he said. And they banned us and labeled us as a hate group for just, I don't know how bad, is that, I don't know how hateful that really is, but obviously it doesn't seem like a hateful comment. We're just saying the values of the Boy Scouts are more great than this.
Okay. And unless you've been hiding under a very large rock the last few weeks or months, guess what, Charlie? It's coming.
Yeah.
Thank you for coming.
My pleasure.
Thank you, Alan,
yeah,
for
my
being
pleasure.
Here.
Yeah.